Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Lara Bryden, and today we'll be mapping ovulation on the 15-minute matrix.
Welcome to the 15-Minute Matrix. I'm Andrea Nakayama, functional medicine nutritionist and your host. This is the podcast that brings you bite-sized insights and lessons on how to use the most important tool in functional medicine and functional nutrition. Today on the 15-Minute Matrix, I'll be talking with Dr. Lara Bryden. Dr. Bryden is a naturopathic doctor and the period revolutionary leading the change to better periods. Informed by a strong science background and more than 20 years with patients, Lara is a passionate communicator about women's health and alternatives to hormonal birth control. Her book, Period Repair Manual, linked in the show notes, is a manifesto of natural treatment for better hormones and better periods, and provides practical solutions using nutrition, supplements, and natural hormones. Now in its second edition, the book has been an underground sensation and has worked to quietly change the lives of tens of thousands of women. Welcome to the 15-Minute Matrix, Lara.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk about ovulation. As I've heard you say, it's the most important time of the cycle. Why is that?
Ovulation is the main event of the cycle because it's how we move through a cycle. It's what defines a cycle, really, into its follicular phase and luteal phase and the timing of the bleed. And also, ovulation is how we, as women, as humans, make hormones, the hormones we need for general health.
Let's talk about that a little bit. If we're talking about the hormones that are produced through ovulation, how do we look at that?
Estrogen and progesterone are important for general health, not just for making a baby. That's kind of my main messages with this. Obviously, we make estradiol, our main hormone leading up to ovulation and sort of throughout the cycle. But progesterone is special in that it only comes in after ovulation. And it's, as you probably know, quite possible to have what are called anovulatory cycles, or cycles when we don't ovulate and therefore don't make progesterone. And that is the true kind of definition of the so-called estrogen dominance. I don't actually use the phrase estrogen dominance because I feel it's not precise enough to describe what's going on. I always speak in terms of, is ovulation happening or not?
When we think about triggering events, it's interesting because you're talking about ovulation itself being a triggering event for the production of hormones. But if we're thinking about problems that might occur with ovulation, what are some of the triggering events for an anovulatory cycle?
I speak about it in terms of obstacles to ovulation, and it's the perfect opportunity for a functional health practitioner to put on a detective hat and think, okay, what are the obstacles to ovulation, of which there's really only a few, and work to correct that. And then the downstream benefit will be that ovulation will find its legs again and happen. Ovulation is not something we should have to actively promote or work at to happen, because the body wants to ovulate when it's given a chance. There's a few things that need to be ruled out by the doctor, but then at the end of the day, it really comes down to the two things of under-eating or PCOS.
Talk a little bit into how those might impact whether or not ovulation occurs.
Both of them impair ovulation. Undereating is the best example to start with. It's just a clear obstacle to ovulation, and it's not a malfunctioning of the body. The hypothalamus's decision to suppress ovulation in the face of inadequate calories, or I would argue inadequate carbohydrate, is an adaptive, evolutionarily smart decision. That's how smart the human body is. It would say, we're not going to attempt a pregnancy when there is clearly not enough food coming in. Because I'm an evolutionary biologist by background, and so I just wanted to share this piece of information.
Yeah.
Humans were one of the few mammals that cannot pause or terminate a pregnancy once it's underway. A lot of other mammals, if they're pregnant and then there's a reduction in food supply, they can hit pause on gestation, which is really interesting. As humans, we can't do that. The stakes are high, so we had to have this mechanism in place to just be extra careful to not embark on a pregnancy if we're not eating enough.
You said under eating and also maybe in the face of not enough carbohydrates, which I think we can start to make some connections there. There's more and more people taking on these diets that are very low in carbohydrates that may be impacting their hormone production without realizing it. Are you seeing that occur in practice?
I am. And I've written a couple of blog posts about it. One is called "Have You Lost Your Period to a Low Carb Diet?" And of course, then there's always the response is like, well, where is the science to back that up? There isn't a lot of science because no one has chosen to look at that question, partly because women are left out of the research, a lot of the nutritional and physiology research, which is my other passion, is to kind of redefine the standard normal version of human as the female version of human. I think if we start to look at the body that way, then everything shifts, then ovulation becomes central. And we start to put everything through that lens of what can we do to support this central event of health. And there are very real reasons, mechanisms, why not enough carbohydrate could trigger the hypothalamus to make that decision. The hypothalamus has glucose-sensing neurons. It's quite sensitive to insulin, calibrated in a way that men are not.
I love that you brought this up. One of my favorite books of late is the book Doing Harm. I don't know if you've read that book, but really looking at the role of women in history and medicine in terms of testing, in terms of dosing, and in terms of working as well. But that testing and that dosing is just fascinating to look at it through a research perspective. So if we think about under eating as an obstacle to ovulation, are there also digestive distresses that could lead to that malnutrition that aren't just about what we consume, but what we can utilize?
The first thing I'll say is that digestive problems, in my experience with my patients, are a common reason for unintentional undereating, which makes sense if you think about it. If a woman is bloating, doesn't feel comfortable with meals, she'll probably try to micromanage, reduce her carbs as a way to reduce bloating. And that is just going to eventually lead to unintentional undereating.
What a good connection there. Yeah, absolutely. And it happens so often that we see that unintentional weight loss also with inflammatory issues that people may be having, like interstitial cystitis. That's a condition where I find that women just stop eating because they're equating what they're eating with the pain that they're experiencing, and they start to limit and limit and limit further and further. Are there any other issues that are impacting the hypothalamus in particular, stress or anything that would induce an ovulatory cycle? Or does the body want to ovulate so badly that it even works around the stress?
Definitely stress can be a reason, a second reason for hypothalamic amenorrhea. And everyone's going to be calibrated differently. You know, I think some people can get away with a bit more stress, some people less so. We do know from the research that under the influence of stress or illness or under eating, any of us, even if we're having fairly regular cycles, can just occasionally not ovulate. I think the first step, the first marker, it's like a wobble in the reproductive system, is the hypothalamus is not quite happy. You'll still progress, try to ovulate, but not get all the way. The signaling just starts to slow down. On the topic of ovulation, just one of the things I like to say is it's so central to our human physiology that I'm pretty sure that if men had to ovulate to make their testosterone, that they would never stop talking about it. It would be this amazing thing that they do every month, and that it also happens to be a handy barometer or report card of what's going on in every other system.
It's true. How do we bring that attention to our ovulation? How do you work with patients to really heighten their awareness so that there's celebration throughout that process?
I do emphasize what I've just said, that it's how we make our beneficial hormones. It's the ultimate goal in terms of health. And I think I communicate it just by always asking them just the simple question, like, are you ovulating? And of course, sometimes women don't know, but we can help them to learn the signs, to track cervical mucus, to take temperatures. I just keep bringing the conversation back to that and saying, once you're well, your body will start to ovulate. We're going to see that. And they can see that as a tangible thing. And I think it reinforces the importance for them.
I love that you're talking about those methods of tracking our ovulation. When I was trying to get pregnant, and this is a very long time ago now, and I always look back and think of it as my first kind of foray into the what's going on in there arena that I love now, because I wasn't getting pregnant easily and I didn't understand what was going on with my body. And so I read the book, Taking Charge of Your Fertility, and I started tracking everything. And this is before, Lara, there were all the trackers that we have access to now on our phones and apps and things that didn't exist at this point. I didn't even have a cell phone. But that awareness of what was actually happening in my body got me out of the drive to just conceive and into the curiosity and learning about my body. It was such a beautiful process. So what are your favorite techniques for highlighting how we find that we're ovulating, and how do you teach people about it?
Well, first, I just want to make the point, you've just said it yourself, but I'll say it slightly differently, that ovulation tracking was the original biohacking.
Yes, you're right. Beautiful.
Why then, you know, men started tracking all these other signs, that there's this major obvious sign that 50% of humans have that is the obvious thing to track. The other word for tracking, which I love, coined by my colleague and friend Laura Wurschler, she coined the term body literacy, which is, I think, really beautiful in terms of reading our menstrual cycle, understanding when we're ovulating, understanding when stress might have affected that, and knowing based on when we ovulate, when our period's going to come. It's very empowering.
Totally.
There's scientific signs. This isn't a nebulous kind of esoteric thing. Our temperature goes up by about half a degree after ovulation because of progesterone, which is a thermogenic heat producing hormone. And we can measure that just with a simple under the tongue temperature first thing in the morning before we've generated any heat from our muscles. And we can track that on pen and paper or in some of the many apps you mentioned.
Yes.
And the second sign is cervical mucus or cervical fluid, which we make under the influence of estrogen, and which is an excellent marker that we're moving towards ovulation. It's no guarantee that we do ovulate, though, because we can see cervical mucus or cervical fluid and then actually not ovulate, which is important to understand.
I'm such a fan of tracking. I think tracking brings us as patients, and we all are, into that body literacy that you were talking about, beautiful term. And then as practitioners, it gives us more clues. And I think we bypass all the clues we could be collecting for the quick fix, for the answer that we think it is, that is more about us looking smart than about really collecting and assessing what's going on. And cycle tracking is one of my favorites. I think it's really important. So what do you find out through the cycle tracking as a practitioner that gives you some of those clues or insights?
We find out if ovulation is occurring. And if not, then we start to look for reasons for that. Sometimes be signs in the temperature pattern, for example, if thyroid is an underlying issue. It's just sort of a question of, are they anovulatory cycles or is there no cycle happening at all?
Right. And then also the timing of everything, like that luteal phase, ovulation to menstruation, tells us a lot, doesn't it?
The strength, the robustness of the temperatures during that 2 weeks between ovulation and the period is what we're looking to see. The other thing to understand about ovulation, it's really worth mentioning, is that there's a lag time. So it's not a real-time tracking, as in things like stress or undereating that are going to impair ovulation typically take 3 to 4 months to show themselves. It's because of what I describe in my book as the 100 days to ovulation. Mm. So the follicle that eventually becomes our dominant or ovulating follicle, it started its journey to ovulation 3 months ago. So it's not unusual to see this 3 to 4 month lag time, both in reading, kind of understanding what caused it, and also once you put treatment in place to seeing the results, you have to wait.
That makes sense. That hidden hunger is that depletion happens over time. So let's go back to the PCOS that you mentioned. Can you talk to us a little bit about the connections between PCOS and ovulation, or conversely, ovulation and PCOS?
PCOS, the way it's currently diagnosed, is a sloppy diagnosis and is doing harm in the sense that a number of women with hypothalamic amenorrhea who are in that first category of undereating are being mistakenly given the diagnosis of PCOS. It's a big problem because with the diagnosis of PCOS, we immediately think about, okay, insulin resistance, low carb is what this, you know, woman needs to try to reverse this. She might have read about that herself on Google somewhere. And so you potentially have the situation where someone whose main cause is undereating, even though they've been given the label PCOS, is starting to go down the wrong path. Mm-hmm. So that would be my first thing to say about PCOS is really take care diagnosing it. By definition, it's a condition of excess androgens, potentially ovulatory dysfunction, when everything else has been ruled out. And that everything else being ruled out should include hypothalamic amenorrhea mm-hmm. or undereating.
From that evolutionary biology perspective, which I love, any other key points that you want to share with practitioners about ovulation?
PCOS is kind of like a superpower in terms of these are the women whose ancestors could manage to reproduce on a lower food supply, who were kind of calibrated a bit differently to kind of keep going and ovulating, which means they're now, unfortunately, more sensitive to kind of excess sugar, and some of the drivers of insulin resistance can then cause their ovulatory pathways to wobble and kind of shut down for a different reason, more from the insulin resistance side of things. So we all have different individuality because of our ancestry.
I really love this conversation focusing on ovulation. I love the idea, Lara, of ovulation as a trigger for the production of all these hormones that we need to survive and to thrive. And I particularly appreciate your awareness of how we bring this to our own awareness, this idea that men would likely be celebrating this if they ovulated, and we get to take that on ourselves now.
Exactly. We get to brag about it, think how great it is. Because estrogen gets kind of a bad rap, but it's one of the most amazing hormones, actually. You know, it's anabolic. It improves muscle mass. It gives us enhanced insulin sensitivity compared to men. It stimulates mitochondria. It's actually, and from an evolutionary biology perspective, I don't know if you knew this, but estrogen is the ancestor to all other steroid hormones, including cortisol, DHEA, testosterone. So arguably, from an evolutionary perspective, the past was female.
I love that. What a beautiful note to end on. Power to the women. Thank you so much, Lara.
Thank you.
The 15-Minute Matrix is brought to you by me, Andrea Nakayama, and the Functional Nutrition Alliance. The 15-Minute Matrix team includes music by my son Gilbert Nakayama and Carla Schaefer on sound production, as well as Renee Hunt, Natalie Merrill, and Christine Shook. You can visit us and hear more episodes at 15minutematrix.com. And if you'd like to be notified each time there's a new podcast episode ready for you, please go to 15minutematrix.com/notify. We'll be sure to drop into your inbox with a really short reminder that a new episode is ready for you. And I really would love to hear from you. You have an open invitation to email us. We want to know who you'd like to hear on the podcast and what you'd like to see mapped on the 15-Minute Matrix. You can always email us or my kitty at ask@15minutematrix.com.